another day. Another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler.
Hi folks, this is Jack Spierka with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Dictated a bit differently today. I'm at home, and it is really different because of a couple things. One, I wanted to do a couple more shows for you guys on the road before I really started broadcasting 99% of the time from the house, but that didn't happen. Yesterday, I did a show for you on the road, and I thought it was a kick-ass show, and I'm going to redo that show today. Hopefully it'll be as good. I thought I did a really good job on the show yesterday. Sometimes I get done with the show and I'm like, I could have done better there. And sometimes I get done with the show and I'm just like, yeah, I nailed that one. And I felt like I did a good job with yesterday's show and it was interesting. And the problem is when you're doing live broadcasting without a script, it will never be the exact same. So hopefully I'll do as good or better today for you from the house than I did yesterday on the road. But it won't be the same, and I apologize for that. And what happened? I put up a technical difficulties thing on the blog, and the guys there all drunk. Was I drunk? No. I drove in. I had my little recorder and my headset hooked up. I did my show, and I got to the office, and I downloaded it. And there were giant pieces of complete blank spots in the show, and there are also parts of the show where I was like, hi, this is Jack, and this is, like that, and so I don't know if the recorder failed or the headset failed, but today I'm watching, you know, my stuff show up on a computer monitor, and I can see that the voice patterns are good, so I know I'm going to get a good show out for you today, and we'll figure out what went wrong with the mobile equipment later on. Today I got to knock this show out for you and try to do the best job I can. Today's show is going to be what usually is a Monday show, even though it's Wednesday, the 30th, which means we only have a couple more days left in 2009, and I, for one, am ready to get it over with because it changes kind of my focus going forward to 100% dedicated to you guys. But this is going to be that listener feedback type show with some current event stuff thrown in, which is part of why I thought this was a cool show yesterday. And again, we'll try to make it good for you today. Before we get on with the show, though, we do have to take care of our sponsor. Sponsor of the day number one is the Berkey Guy at Directive21.com. It's just got some great feedback on the Berkey Guy from a listener that says he called him up, guy cut him a deal on some things because some stuff was out of stock, really took good care of him, and the guy said, I never felt like he was selling me. I thought I was talking to a friend that just wanted to make sure I got what I needed. That's what I look for in sponsors. Sponsors that take care of the audience. That's what the Berkey Guy does, and he's going to help you have pure, clean water to drink at home or anywhere you go. So check out the Berkey Guy. Again, his website is directive21.com. Also, check out Safe Castle Royal. I got an announcement about Safe Castle Royal. Vic over there just put together a board of advisors to advise Safe Castle on the industry and look at new products and decide whether to bring them in or not and things like that. And he asked me to serve on that advisory board. So I'm now a member of the Safe Castle Advisory Board. And I'm really honored to serve that in that capacity. It's not a lot of work or anything, but it's really an honor to be on a group with people like Ron Hood and Bobo Camp and some other folks that are there. I'll link to Safe Castle today. If you look down in the bottom left-hand corner, you'll see the member advisory board. You'll see the products that we individually recommend from Safe Castle there. But check out Safe Castle. Really solid company. Takes care of folks. All right. From that point forward, let's knock out the rest of the housekeeping really, really quick today for you so I can focus on getting the show right and redone. Number one, get involved with our forum. If you're not involved with our forum, why not? That's the only question I have for you. If you get involved with our forum, you're going to make connections with people, you're going to form relationships, and you're going to get an amazing amount of knowledge. If you go look at our forum, it's almost overwhelming at first. That's okay. Start out in the subjects that are most interesting to you. You'll make friendships from there. When you hear about something on the show and you want to know more about it, go to a board about that subject and start digging into what people are actually doing. It's amazing what you can learn. I think there's a PhD in preparedness for anybody that wants it sitting there for free if you'll just get involved with our forum. Next, get involved with all our social network stuff. Man, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I have a YouTube channel. If you use any of those services, you'll be able to see the options to subscribe to them on the website in the center column. I'll leave it at that. Get involved. And if you think the show's worth more than 20 cents an episode, consider joining the Member Support Brigade. You get exclusive content available only to members, really cool discounts, really cool free e-publications, and I'm working on some really exciting discounts with some folks right now, trying to get some good deals set up for you guys as we go into 2010. So I will always be expanding the value of the Members Brigade, always. Consistently, constantly, forever. That's what I mean by giving back to the people that support the show. All right, with that, let's go ahead and get into today's actual main topic. I'm going to start out with something that was sent to me by a guy named Greg. Now, Greg's a good buddy, even though I've never met him. I've been interacting with Greg by email for a long time now. He's always been really insightful in some of the things that he sent me and information that he sent me, and he's currently living his dream. He took an early retirement, and he and his family are driving across the country in an RV right now, and that's pretty cool. In fact, you can check out his website, rv-103.com, rv-103.com. I'll link to it in the show notes today. But he sent me an email that I found pretty interesting. It came off of, where did it come off of, Newsweek? Yeah, Newsweek. No, not Newsweek. USA Today? I don't know. There'll be a link in the show notes so you can see where this thing came from. And I looked it up on a couple different newspapers. It's out in a few newspapers. And ended up having to do the reporter's job for them to find out one of the questions I know that everybody would have. But this is about new solar panels that are available at Lowe's. Now, don't get excited and run out to your Lowe's. Right now, this is only available at select stores in California, but there's 20 or 30 stores that have these new panels. Basically, this is how these new panels work. You figure out which side of your roof is the sunny side of your roof. You go up with a ladder. You put some bolts into the rafters. You seal them, you put a frame there, and you put a panel there. And you run a wire down, you plug it directly into the circuit breaker. Because they have an integrated inverter built into them. So that once you run that down there, it's putting AC power straight to the house. Now, the next thing that's really cool is if you buy five of them, you only run one wire. And they just kind of snap together and expand out like an erector set. How much are these? $875 a panel. And, can you do, you know, kind of a self-done type of solar arrangement for less? Yeah. If I was going to do it, would I do it for less? Probably. You know, would I do it on my own with battery backup and things like that? Probably. But I'll tell you what. If I could buy these things right now, given I'm getting ready to sell this house in a few months, I would probably buy five of these right now if I just could. Throw them up on my roof. Snap them into my electrical system, point them south, and use it as an added incentive to sell the house and get my my rebate. Now, on that, this is the real reason I brought this up. You would think that people from the solar industry would be on board with this. And to be fair, there was an installer in this article that was on board with it. He said, hey, if a guy wants five panels, he can't afford to have my truck come out there. So for the small jobs, I'm glad to see something like this. But there was, I'll call him an ass clown, Jeff Wolf, of CEO of Grow Solar. And what he said, there's a quote from him there, if you don't get the right permits and don't fill out the right paperwork and you put solar panels on your roof by yourself, bad things can happen to you. I think Mr. Wolf is afraid of mass-produced consumer-level product in his industry. I think he's afraid he's going to get his ass kicked because apparently Mr. Wolf feels that his ability to come out and survey the sky, determine what your solar exposure is, spec the right equipment, install the right equipment, that's not his real value. His real value is that he can pull permits and fill out paperwork. So you'll get your rebate and you'll comply with local ordinances and utility ordinances. I think you can fill out your own paperwork, folks. And what I'm excited about with this product is not this product itself. I don't think it's the end-all, be-all of new solar technology, by a long shot. It's a step in the right direction. When we start taking panels that anybody can install, with a modicum of intelligence, and putting them into mass production environments and major retail outlets, we start to spread solar out to the average everyday person. The person like yourself may still decide eventually, I want to build something bigger, but for a suburban home, come on, if you can throw $4,000 or $5,000 into it and recoup, you know, your money back in 5 to 6 years, it's probably worth it because then the resale value that goes on top of that house going forward to the next buyer is extreme. Additionally, this is the big thing. Additionally, the warranty on them is 25 years. And what that means is that, you know, you have a good long-term product. Now, there's one more big thing here. I don't see this as a product or a single event. I see this as an emerging trend. And I'm very, very excited about it as an emerging trend. This weekend, before I got this article, we took a trip to Costco, which we like to do because it's a great place to stock up on prep level stuff on the, you know, on a you know, day eat, we store eat basis. We're in there, and I go over to where they keep the generators and all the stuff like that to see whatever they have that's new, because I like to see. And there's a box sitting there, do-it-yourself solar backup kit. All you have to add is a 12-volt battery. It's got like four or five panels. They combine to make a 60-watt output, a little PVC frame, an inverter, a charge controller, everything you need. Basically, all you do is go home, put it together, point it at the sun, hook a battery up to it, $200-something. I almost bought it. I thought I can build something better than that on my own, but I almost bought it. I'm probably going to go back and buy it and review it for you guys. Now, how are these two things? One's this little backup system, right? And then the other one is like something that goes on your house and puts energy into your house. How are these related? Because what we're seeing is mass production, retail level distribution to the average person in a snap together type of thing. I think this is falling apart for the energy companies at this point. There's too much momentum now. And there's going to be a lot of resistance, and it's going to come from weird sources. It's going to come from people like Mr. Wolf in the solar industry who've bet their livelihood on doing high expensive installations that don't want it to be easy, and it's going to come from the energy companies themselves, and it's going to come from government. One thing Wolf was right about, he said if you don't fill out the right paperwork, bad things can happen to you. Well, it can. I told you the government doesn't want solar panels on your roof. Now, some of your local governments might. They might really be behind it. The federal government does not want the average American to have solar panels. It's a lie. It's nonsense. They certainly don't want you to have enough to provide for most or all of your energy needs. We're heading in that direction now with this type of technology being put out to the general public. And we're a long way from really getting there. But the days when you can go and just go to the store and probably drop less than $5,000 and provide 90% of the electricity needs of the average person on needs, not wants, needs, are probably 5 to 7 years away at this point. If everything stays put and if nobody gets in the way, which could happen, it's happened before. But I think the lid's off. I liken this to the phone company getting broken up and finding out the truth. A lot of our listeners probably are too young to remember the days when your phone belonged to the phone company, you had to lease it, and you weren't allowed to plug a phone in, folks. You weren't allowed to unplug a phone. You weren't allowed to move a phone. If you wanted a new phone in your house, you had to call the phone company. They brought you one. If you wanted your phone moved from like location A to location B, they sent a technician out, charged you a fee, and he went over and he just basically stapled the wire along the wall. But you were told if you disconnected the phone or messed around with it, you could mess the whole thing up for everybody. That it was dangerous for you to touch the wire. That lie was told to the American people for 70 years by the Bell companies. And of course, we all know today you can plug a phone in anywhere you want. There's no danger. It doesn't cause any harm. It doesn't do anything. Anybody can do it. Well, I think a lot of the things with solar and wind are that way too. And it's just a matter of developing, you know, to click together technologies that will allow that. That's what we're starting to see. I'm really excited. I know I went long, but I'm excited on this one. The next thing I want to talk about, I can't give credit to anybody for sending it to me because like about 50 of you did. Various stories about this. But the number one story people were sending me was from LouRockwell.com, and it was basically something versus the Keystone Cops, but it was about the underwear bomber. All right? The underwear bomber, this guy that built a bomb in his underwear and tried to blow up a plane on Christmas Eve in Detroit and set his ass on fire, and that was all he accomplished. And even if the bomb went off, when you look at it legitimately, you probably would think that maybe he would have killed himself and a few people around him, and that would have been it. He probably wouldn't have blown a hole in the plane and brought the plane down. So it was kind of a non-starter. Now, here's what's bothering me, and the lady on Lou Rockwell just tears this stuff up way better than I can. So I'll let you read her article. I'll put a link today. And again, there's going to be a ton of links in today's show. So go by, check the show notes out, check these links, and follow up on this stuff, because this is going to be cool. This is the thing that just drove me crazy through the holidays. I kept hearing about the story. They said the thwarted hijacking attempt. It wasn't a thwarted attempt. It was a failed attempt. Those are very, very different. Thwarted would have been, either by the government or even by the passengers. You see the guy trying to detonate the device, you stop him. That's thwarting. He set it off. He caught his ass on fire. It didn't explode. That's a failed attempt. And then the passengers beat him silly. Now here's the thing that came out, and this is what's in the Lou Rockwell article, and I really encourage you to go read this. It turns out that the TSA's secret manual for screening terrorists and how they view the whole situation was leaked onto the internet several weeks before this happened. Yes, their secret manual is available by download as a PDF. Isn't that great? They're out to protect us. And it turns out that you and I, Mr. and Mrs. America, are considered the number one line of defense against terrorists on airplanes. Our self-defense initiative is considered to be the primary thing that will prevent another terrorist attack on an aircraft. In other words, when a guy tries to do something, they know after 9/11 that you and I are going to stand up and risk our own lives and beat the guy to death because his goal is not to take the plane someplace to negotiate, it's to bring it down and kill us or kill people on the ground too. And we're not going to die that way. If we're going to die, we're going to die fighting. And that's in the average person. So isn't it ironic that we're completely and totally disarmed when we get on an aircraft? Law-abiding citizens completely, totally disarmed. Additionally, this jackass, this underwear bomber, that's now going to have us scanned by equipment that makes us naked for a couple seconds so some pervert can look at us, right? This guy, his dad told the U.S. State Department he was dangerous and radical. And we didn't put him on the terror watch list. I bet you I'm probably on the frickin' terror watch list because I tell you to be prepared for disasters. But this ass clown wasn't. This is a complete failure of the system, and now their solution is to have us body scanned, show up to the airport 3 to 6 hours early, not let international passengers have something on their lap for the last hour of the flight, even though they've had 13 hours to do whatever it is. That's just stupid. And that more and more things that are just going to destroy the airline industry. Isn't that wonderful? So I thought I'd bring that up. I wanted you to know this, though. I wanted you to know that the Transportation Security Authority, that's supposed to be responsible for you, that says they know what they're doing, that's working really hard to protect you, allowed their secret screening methodology to be released onto the internet due to incompetence. I'm at a point where the only reason I haven't done this yet is I don't want to put it somewhere else until I get there. I'm buying a small RV this year, like I've talked about for a while. And I'll tell you what, I'm towing that sucker anywhere I got to go in the continental United States. I'm not flying anymore. I've had enough. You know what? They can choke on it. When they stop charging me for my bags, they stop telling me I can't hold something in my lap the last hour on my flight, and I don't have to be there 4 hours in advance to get on a plane to go somewhere I could drive in five. When they stop doing that nonsense, then, and only then, will I get back on airplanes again. I'm done. Wyoming for third time this year, driving. Right? And everything else, I'm driving. I've had enough. I suggest you do it too where and when you can. I understand you can't do it everywhere, but you know what? They're making this mess for themselves. Let them suffer for it. And maybe they'll get wise to doing things in a constructive way. And let's start deciding for a while maybe that, you know what? It's Middle Eastern males that blow up airplanes. And that's it. Period. And when your own father calls the government and tells them that you're a dangerous, radical Islamic extremist, when he himself is a Muslim, it's like, hey, this guy, you gotta do something. Hey, you know, let's step up and do it. So I'll let that go. I don't want to turn this into a political show or current event show, but I wanted to open up with those two things because they're decidedly different, but we do need to stay in touch with the things going on around us. The next question, though, and this one is a question, comes to me from Michael. And Michael says, can you freeze-dry food at home? Because it's very expensive to buy freeze-dried food from, you know, major suppliers. And freeze-dried food obviously has better quality than simply dehydrating food. It's almost indistinguishable from food that was never frozen or dried. It's almost indistinguishable from fresh. Well, freeze-drying, in the words of James Talmadge Stevens, is the best and most expensive method to preserve food. So there's a reason that these vendors that sell freeze-dried food charge a comparatively large amount of money compared to going out and just dehydrating it yourself, because the process is expensive. The way freeze-drying works is you take the food and you flash freeze it. And in general, especially with meats and things that are thick, it has to be an extremely fast freezing. And then that freezing is done inside of a vacuum chamber. And at the point the freezing is taking place, the vacuum is initiated, and all the moisture is sucked out of the food, effectively drying it after it's being frozen. Once that's done, you can take it out of the freezer, and it won't be frozen anymore, but it'll stay dried in that freeze-dry type of situation where it's extremely light, but not as shrinked up, let's say, as something like that's been typically dehydrated. Because its cellular structure is held rigid by the freezing, and then the moisture is pulled out of the cellular structure while held rigid. Sort of like a sponge that dries out, that retains its shape, right? Becomes very light and very rigid. So my initial response is going to be, no, you can't do it at home. You need special equipment. It's very expensive. It turns out you can, sort of. You can experiment with it is what I found in this little article that I'll post a link to today. And basically you need a pan with a lot of holes in the bottom, kind of like one of those that you maybe cook on the grill with. It's designed so food doesn't fall through the grill. And you take your food and you want to use something that's relatively easy to freeze dry, like carrots or potatoes, and there's some other suggestions there. And it used to be cut very thin, almost paper thin, to do this at home. And you spread them out one layer on this pan with the holes in the bottom, you just stick them in the freezer and leave them there. They'll freeze, and after they freeze, because they're thin, and because they have air circulation on both sides, the cold, dry environment of the freezer will begin to suck the moisture out of them. After about a week, you take one piece out, throw it on your countertop, and if it turns black, it's not done yet. If it doesn't turn black, it's done. You can put it in any kind of storage container, and you basically have created freeze-dried potatoes or freeze-dried carrots. The thing is, freeze-dried potatoes and carrots aren't that expensive to begin with. They dehydrate very well. I don't know how practical this is, but it is something you can experiment with. But it has me thinking. Building a vacuum chamber is not that hard. Building a vacuum chamber inside of some type of a freezer shouldn't be that difficult. I wonder if we could get some engineering minds together and come up with, hey, let's take this model freezer, this type of thing, and this, and maybe come up with something that maybe would even be a little bit expensive, but a community could go in together on and have a community freeze dryer. It just might be possible, and it may not be that out of reach. And if it was something where it was like five families owned it and it rotated on a weekly basis, you have week one, I have week two, if week three, something like that, you could probably get an awful lot of your own freeze-drying done. That would be a great way to store food. So I never really thought it was possible, but this is intriguing. So great question from you, Michael. And you know what? I'm going to try the little experiment myself, and I'll let you guys know how it works out. Maybe I'll even do a YouTube video, but it sounds kind of fun. All right. Janet in Washington has a different question. She wants to know how she finds a good piece of land for a fallback location, a bug-out location, secondary location, vacation home, call it what you want. But she wants to have a place outside of the city where she can go to. And here's the key. She wants it to be less than 100 miles away. Given that she's in the coastal area of Washington, she has mountains to the west, Canada to the north. So there's a limit to where you can go. I'd say look up into those mountains, Janet. Those mountains provide an awful lot of shelter. And if you stay on the ocean side of those mountains, you get a fair amount of rain every year, and it only gets so cold. The backside of the Cascades is effectively a shadow desert. Because what happens is the rain clouds come up against a dump, and when they pass over, they create a rain shadow. And you have to go pretty far to the east before you start having appreciable rainfall again throughout most of the year. So I would stay on your side of the Cascades, but I'd get some elevation. And I would do it because one of your primary threats in that area is going to be tsunami, earthquake, and volcanic activity. So getting to the east and getting some elevation will help you with that. If you can find something up into those mountains along a pass where if you had to evacuate further due to ash clouds or something, it's not a huge priority. I don't see a lot of volcanic activity likely to occur that's going to be that dangerous if you're that far away up into the Cascades. But get away from the big volcanoes up there. And the big one, though, is tsunami. This is something our own government has said. It's a matter of time before the west coast of the United States has a catastrophic tsunami-type event. And a matter of time could be 1,000 years or 5,000 years or 50 years or 5 years or 5 days. We really don't know. Just like the one that happened in Indonesia, everything was beautiful, here comes the wave. And there's a potential for much larger tsunami activity on the West Coast, and there's historical evidence on the shorelines of very, very large tsunamis in the past. much larger than what happened in Indonesia. So those are your, like, your area-specific things to worry about. Now, here's what I have to say, though, about kind of a generic overall looking for land. One of the things that Janet said is, how do I find land I can buy from an individual instead of, you know, buying from a real estate agent that only seems to be worried about a big commission? Don't worry about the real estate agent's commission to a large degree, because property only gets to sell for the market value anyway. Using a real estate agent costs the seller far more than it costs the buyer. Because I've talked about this in the past when we talk about real estate. You go to buy real estate, and you go to a bank and you want a mortgage against the real estate, and they say, well, what would you like to pay for the property? And you say, $180,000. And they say, great, go out and get a market analysis performed, an appraisal. And they get a certified appraiser. A certified appraiser comes in and says, this property is worth today on today's market value $160,000. And the bank says, we will give you a loan based on $160,000. And you go to the seller and go, it's not worth $180,000. The bank says it's worth $160,000. Nobody else is going to be able to finance it any higher. And the price comes down. That's how I bought this property here that I live in right now in Arlington. I got $20,000 off the property that way. And I didn't even argue the value of the property because I already knew. I'd already done my own assessment, and my assessment was that it was about 15 to 20 high. And it was amazing how close I was, just because I shopped a lot before I actually started to actually shop to try to buy something. And that will happen anyway. So don't worry about real estate agents. Don't begrudge a person that does a good job getting paid for it. But you can often get a better deal from a private seller because they'll often sell under market value. Because let's say I have a place for $200,000, and that is the fair market value is $200,000. Well, if I use a real estate agent, they're going to make $12,000, so that means I'm going to get $188,000. So if I sell to you at $194,000, I come out ahead by $6,000 that I take directly out at the point of sale. So I'm encouraged to do that. On a mortgage payment, let's be real. $194,000, $200,000, what are we talking about? $75 in payment, maybe? Maybe? Difference? So it's not that big a deal for you, the buyer. The thing is, you never want to overpay for property, and since the days of, like, wink, wink, nod, nod are over for a while, you're not going to do that right now anyway. As far as finding property, shop, 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 shop. Those are the rules. Shop. Shop everywhere, all the time, constantly. When you're bored at work and you're eating lunch at your desk and you don't have to be working, your boss is not going to be on your ass for doing it, get on United Country, get on Realtor, look at different properties, see the way, and then when you find a property that seems close to what you want, note it and track it and watch how long it stays on the market at that price. If it sells in 30 days or less, it was fairly priced. Or a deal was negotiated on the back end. Get a real estate involved as a agent involved as a buyer's agent that can track things like this for you. All right? Because they'll be able to tell you what the property actually sold, was listed for, how long it was listed, and what it sold for. Real estate agents, good ones, rare as they may be, are worth their weight in gold. They earn their money. Use them. Next question that she asked is, a lot of these properties come and don't convey mineral rights. What's up with that? Odds are that most of the properties you're looking at, the person selling them to you doesn't own the mineral rights. Somebody else does. Mineral rights are the right to extract minerals from the land itself. Coal, oil, natural gas, zinc, anything that would be down there that would be valuable. Sometimes mineral rights are specific, and sometimes they're non-specific. Sometimes they're specific as this person has the rights to extract natural gas. Some it is any and all minerals. You have to look at that. The key is what's down there. If there's nothing down there, it doesn't really matter. Because somebody with mineral rights can't just come onto your property and bulldoze your house and take it over. All they have the right to do is extract. So if there's nothing there, there's no reason for them to extract. And in a lot of places, mineral rights have been out of the hands of the homeowners for over 100 years or more. If you really are concerned, you can find out who has the mineral rights to see if they'd be interested in selling them back to you. If there's nothing down there, they very well might be interested in selling them back to you because they have no value to them. Right? So, but, you know, everybody's waiting for the day that somebody figures out how to make quartz into a battery. So that's why they sit on these things and hold them, because then, you know, they would have, you know, a huge amount of quartz, which is pointless because so does everybody else. So I wouldn't worry about that too much. The big thing with land, though, is ask yourself, what do I want out of the land? You want to be able to go there anytime you want to make it into something that's perfect for you. So you've already decided on a 100-mile or less radius. So that's one factor. But what other things do you want? Do you want a garden there? Do you want to do permaculture there? Do you just want it to be a fallback location? Do you want it to be a vacation property? Establish the criteria and then look for a piece of land that fits the criteria. That's how you buy real estate anyway. I don't care if it's in the city or in the country. I don't care if it's a primary residence, a secondary residence, a third-level residence. I don't care what it is, a community buy where you're doing some type of, you know, we're buying a big piece of land and dividing up into four sections among four families. It doesn't matter. What do you want, and how close can you get to what you want for the price that you can afford to pay? What you can afford to pay is as much as you pay, period. Don't never go over your budget. Be patient. Be ready to walk away from any deal. On top of this, I've done numerous shows about identifying land and criteria for land. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Put in BOL, which stands for bug out location, into the search box. You'll find a ton of shows that address this deeper. So best they can do for you there. Let's move on from that to some other questions. I got some great ones today. Eric asked me, what do you think of Tom Brown's tracker knife, and is there a lower cost alternative that would be as functional? Let me say before I go forward, no disrespect to Mr. Brown. I think he's a great guy. I think he's written some great books. I'm standing here looking at one of his books, actually two of his books in a condensed down to one book version, sitting on my bookshelf right now. I think his knife is a very, very good quality knife. I think it's very functional, and I think if you bought one, I wouldn't say a dirty word about it, and I would say you probably got your money's worth. Personally, I'm not going to spend over $200 on a 6-inch bladed knife that is from a that somebody else is going to be walking around with the exact same knife. So I'm going to go into that range, that expense on a knife. I'm going to deal with a small businessman that's a custom knife maker, and I'm going to have something built unique to me. It may not even be as hard as steel or whatever, but it's going to be exactly what I want. And when we get into these price ranges of $200, there's a lot of custom knife makers out there, little small guys that do really good work that are underrated, that maybe not have a big name, but you now have a personal relationship with the person that made your knife. And I would go that way first. If I'm going to buy something that's kind of a mass market product in the $200 to $300 price range, I'm a lot more likely to go to somebody like Cold Steel and look at their Gurkha Kukri. Which is an amazing tool. It's a lot bigger than the Tom Brown tracker, but in that price point, I want a lot more out of the tool, and it either needs to be some kind of a bond and some kind of knowledge that I'm putting my energy, which I represent with money, back into my United States economy, right? And I'm putting it there with an individual, not with a distribution chain of five layers to get it back to the guy that actually originated it. I want that connection, or I want something I'm buying a lot more. I'm getting a lot more for not taking that pathway. So the Gurkha Kukri, if you look at the videos on Cold Steel of this thing, it's amazing. Now, I just said I want to put my money back in the country, so you're going to be surprised at kind of the next knife that I would recommend is a low-end, really rugged, tough survival knife, because it's made in China, but it's also a Cold Steel product, and it's called the Bushman. And you know, if America will make a knife just like that, I'll buy it. Well, the Cold Steel Bushman is an amazing value. The dollar-for-dollar value of the Bushman is absolutely amazing. You're talking about a $30 knife. If you buy from the manufacturer direct, and you can get it for less through his distribution channels, and you're talking about a knife that can be turned into a spear, it has a hollow handle, but you can put it in a vise and bend it 90 degrees, and it goes back to its original form. It's very sharp. It holds an edge. It sharpens easily. It's just got so much going for it that I'm a lot more likely to buy two of those for $40, or two of those for $30 a piece. And put one on the shelf, and if one ever has a problem, throw it away and get the other one. And I'm still got a lot of other money that can be put into things like expanding my permaculture efforts or my alternative energy or my food storage. So I'm not likely to make that investment in that knife personally, but I would understand why you did. Let's talk about what I carry. Day-to-day, I carry a Buck 110 in most situations because it carries a lot like a Leatherman. People don't realize that it's actually a fairly large knife. There's a video where I review the Buck 110 and my other main carry knife, which is the small frame K-bar. And I like the K-bar. It's legal to carry without having to be pursuing fishing game or whatever other nonsense because the blade's under 6 inches. But it still looks rather large in the sheath, so I use it more in my backyard or when I am out, you know, in the bush or something like that. Just because if you walk into a store or through town with the K-bar on your side, in this area, it raises eyebrows. There's a lot of places in Arkansas you walk around with it. The guy'd be like, hey, can I see that? That's pretty cool. So those are what I carry day to day. And on top of that, I have about a $2, maybe $1.50, little lockback folder with a kind of rubber handle and a pocket clip that's on my keychain. And I probably use that knife more than anything else because it's always with me. It's always on my keys. I use it for everything from opening boxes to poking holes in a cup of coffee that I might buy at the grocery store so that when I drink it, it gets an good airflow and it comes out smooth. I mean, that's just, and I use it for everything, and it's a $2 knife. So what happens when it starts to get wobbly or the clip breaks off or whatever, I throw it away and replace it. I have a box of them sitting on my shelf. So I think we can overdo knives, and this is why I get into it with people that, I don't know, you think you're going to be Rambo or something out there, and you're going to go live with just a knife. It's good to have a good knife. A knife is extremely utilitarian. It can save your life. It's one of the most valuable things you can own, not just as a survivalist, but as a human. It's one of the greatest creations of mankind when somebody figured out, hey, if we take this piece of obsidian and do this with it, we'll make a sharp edge, and we can cut things. It's an advancement for society. It's a defensive weapon. It's a tool. It can be used to improvise a trap. It can create things for you, but when it comes down to it, you can't eat it. And this mythology that some, you know, especially the wilderness-minded survivalists run around with, of, I'm going to go live with just my knife. Well, if you have to do that, you've screwed something up really bad. Because you should have had time to prepare. If you have time to prepare to have a $200 knife on your back, you should be carrying at least a few other things with you. That's all I'm saying there. So don't overthink the knife things, friends. My thing with knives is, if I like a knife and I can afford a knife and I want it, I buy it. And if I buy a knife and I go, that's not really a great knife, I'll throw it out on eBay, get some of my money back, and lesson learned, and I don't buy that knife again. And I think we think about knives too much. But if I'm going to make a big investment again, I'm going to go to a custom knife maker. Because I'm going to have something that's mine and me. And that's pretty cool. All right. Next question comes from Brian. Brian sent me this article. Again, I'll link to this article. About the emergence of a new strain of tuberculosis for the first time ever in the United States. A highly drug-resistant strain of tuberculosis. So Brian says in his email, I think that the government may have to worry more about tuberculosis than H1N1. On some levels, I think we might have to worry about tuberculosis more than H1N1. The day a disease becomes the problem of our government, it becomes a much bigger problem for us. We're the ones that'll die. Okay? And remember, we are a government of the people, by the people, for the people. So the government is us. As disturbing as that is to many of us. When we look at our government, we feel like they're totally disconnected to us. They're not. They're not. Go to a major city, go into the downtown area of that city, and go talk to the people that live in a series of boxes. They have a box at home, they have a box they get to work in, they have a box they work in, and they go back and forth in those boxes. And they just don't want anything to mess up the temperature of their pool. And if you talk to them, they're a far bigger reflection of our government than we'd like to admit. Right? So those people up there are people just like us. They do a lot of things I don't like, but these diseases are everybody's problem. That's what I've said from the beginning. Pandemic, to me, is probably the biggest individual threat that we face as a society globally. It is the one thing that absolutely can and will take you out no matter how much you've done to prepare for it. In fact, there's only really one good defense against pandemic, and that's isolation and quarantine. And that's it. And that's really the only thing you can do. And it's why I am so big on stored food, the ability to provide your own energy if we end up in a situation where it happens everywhere and people aren't going to work and people aren't traveling. Right? Be the ability to provide yourself water and food and shelter and to stay put. Maybe to have a fallback location that's more remote to go to. Now, that said, let's talk about the tuberculosis thing for a minute. Tuberculosis is dangerous. It is a problem. It does spread human to human. It does not spread human to human like a cold or a flu virus does. It is a bacteria. And what that means is it's generally very close proximity. And where we see the biggest problems with tuberculosis in South America today is in their prison systems, because we're in an institutional environment where people are in close confinement. One of the most nefarious or infamous or famous, depending on how you look at him, Americans ever died of tuberculosis. He was a guy named Doc Holliday, friend of the Earps and part of the OK Corral shootout. He died in his 30s of tuberculosis in the 1800s, the late 1800s. Now, it's interesting, his profession was that of a dentist before he kind of became kind of a nefarious gambling outlaw. And, of course, dentists get very close face-to-face with their patients. And they didn't know a lot about wearing masks and things like that then, so that's probably how this guy got tuberculosis. That's how it spread. Very close contact. So I don't worry about tuberculosis as much as I do something like the resurgence of the bubonic plague, or a mutation and a spread of another illness or disease or virus or bacterium. It's a concern. I'm worried about it. But even in the places where it is, it's not running rampant in parts of the place with good hygiene and things like that. It's a potential thing that can create pockets of danger. And it can be danger to you as an individual. Remember, if somebody fires a shot up into the air, if it lands on somebody, it kills them. Well, that might not be very, you know, dangerous generally, but if you have to be the person that the bullet lands on, really bad news for you. And that's how I see tuberculosis right now. Standard, plain, everyday old tuberculosis is still killing thousands and thousands and thousands of people every year in Africa, where they have very close confined quarters, very poor hygiene, very poor medical care, and they don't have access to the medicines that are used to treat tuberculosis successfully in the United States. Now, here's the irony. That life-saving medicine, those antibiotics, are what have created this super killer tuberculosis. See, what happens is you got a person, he's got tuberculosis, and you treat him with penicillin, and you put the tuberculosis into heavy, heavy remission. But what survives, the tuberculosis bacterium that survive in this individual's body that may eventually spread somewhere else, have some resistance to penicillin. That's why they survived. Now they transmit to somebody else eventually. We treat him with penicillin. And now a larger portion of the bacterium survive because they've developed more resistance. And we keep doing this successively over and over again, and eventually we end up with tuberculosis with a massive resistance to any particular antibiotic. And what they did with this guy in the article, you can read it for yourself, is they threw the kitchen sink at it. They treated him with things that have never been used for tuberculosis before. The doctor said, it's not like I could look it up in a manual. So I am deeply concerned about disease and pandemic as a whole. I am less concerned about which disease or pandemic it will be. I'm less concerned about whether it's going to be a bacteria-based thing or a virally based thing. What I can tell you is that bacteria and viruses that have the capability to infect human beings are constantly mutating, and mutating at a rate that is incomprehensible to the human mind, so fast that it outpaces our federal debt, to put it in perspective for you, right? It outpaces our deficit growth. It's phenomenal. And all the virus needs, or all the bacterium needs, is one good day for the numbers to come up right like the lottery, where it becomes effective at transmission and lethality. And the day those numbers add up, we have a real problem. And at that point, the only thing we can do is hunker down and try to isolate ourselves from exposure and build up our immune systems as best we can. And all these people that have big belief in medical science, it may even be medical science that saves the day, but while they are doing it, millions and millions and millions and millions of people will die. And that's a sad fact, and it is a fact, and it's happened over and over and over in the history of humanity. There's a bottleneck in the human gene sequencing that says that mankind, at a point not that long ago, almost became extinct. It just, the genes just bottlenecked down and then branched back out. And it was probably disease that caused it. If we ever get something with the lethality and spreading power, let's say of the lethality of the bubonic plague and the ability to spread like the common cold or flu, we're going to have a real problem. Sooner or later it will happen. None of us may live to see it, or it may happen next week. This is a primary reason to prepare. Check the article out. Let's go on to something maybe a little less of a downer, but not so much. Another Eric, different Eric than the last one, sends me an email and says, you're not the only one that hates Monsanto. Check out this article on Yahoo Finance. So it's about an attempt to bring antitrust lawsuits against Monsanto. Monsanto, for those of you who have never heard me talk about before, I hate Monsanto and their policies and the things that they're doing throughout the world with a passion that exceeds my hatred of just about any politician. I find Monsanto and their mission to be more dangerous and deadly than any individual politician anywhere in the world. And I'm including nut jobs throughout our world like Hugo Chavez. All right, I think Monsanto's more dangerous than Hugo Chavez. Chavez is a nut. There's no doubt about it. But he doesn't control 90% of the seed supply that supplies the world's food. Hugo Chavez cannot do so much as raise a finger to affect genuinely what you eat for breakfast tomorrow morning. Can't do it. Can't do it. Monsanto. Now, in this article, you can look at it and read it for yourself, has access and control of 90% of the seed used for agriculture throughout the world. 90%. This is a company who has created in their laboratories and tested in their field, but not yet deployed, created a Terminator gene. A gene that's designed to keep the next generation of seed from being fertile. So if I sell you a bunch of corn and you're Farmer Joe, it makes sure that you don't save any of that seed. You have to sell it all as food and come back to me to buy seed again next year. What's so terrible about that? Well, here's the thing. When you start messing around at the genetic level with food and plants and living things in biology, they're not stagnant. It's not like sitting in a laboratory and making a synthetic chemical that only goes where you put it. I take corn and I put it out in the field and the wind blows and the pollen distributes it. And it cross-pollinates with other fields. And they cross-pollinate with other fields. And one stand of corn could affect corn on the downwind side for 100 miles over time or further. Honestly, it can circumnavigate the globe at some point. It really can, because as, you know, Bob's corn gets infected, he does save some seed because he didn't know, and the Terminator gene didn't come all the way through in the first generation, and he then sells his seed to other people who planted it elsewhere, and the process continues, and it's just like a disease. It's only a matter of time until that gene resurges, becomes a dominant force, and all of a sudden we have crops where the crop is fine, but the seed from the crop planned to grow next year's food dies. These people invented that gene. And the only reason they didn't market it is because people went absolutely apeshit and said, you've gone too far. These people took a fish's gene and stuck it into corn. They have created a natural pesticide in corn that if the corn borer eats the corn borer dies, and then they feed it to you and the animals that you eat. That's what these people have done, and they now control 90% of the world's seed supply at the big agricultural level. The only thing holding them back, you and me in our backyard gardens and small organic farmers that won't touch their stuff with a 10-foot pole, but they're doing everything they can to buy out every little seed manufacturer. This is why I say do business with Seeds of Change, Seed Savers Exchange, Baker Creek, High Mowing, all of these little seed houses. Give them business to help them be strong and stable. People say, well, who do you buy from? I could buy, honestly, all my seeds from any one of the people I just told you. Every year, in fact, I buy more seed than I need every year because seeds are cheap. I always spread my business out among those four and some other little small Solara seeds and some out of Canada. I buy seed from anywhere that I find that people are doing business the right way. I buy a few packs of seed. It's an easy way for me to help them. I am a member of Seed Savers Exchange on an annual membership of $35. If you care about this stuff, be a member of Seed Savers Exchange. It's an easy way to help support the effort that they do, and you get discounts on their products, and you get catalogs and stuff like that, and it's cool. It's a way to help. But, guys, you got to understand why I'm so passionate about growing your own food. And I'll hold off on that because the next question kind of goes into that in a variety of ways. Just understand, these people are, in my opinion, the devil incarnate. They really are. They are absolutely scum of the earth, these people and what they're doing. There's very few people or organizations that I get this upset when I talk about them, but they are that bad. Because even if they believed in what they were doing, even if there was nothing nefarious about this, even if they thought they could control it, it is arrogant to believe that you can control life. And it is arrogant to believe that you should have a right to patent life. And that's my big thing. Monsanto places patents on living organisms. And when that living organism does travel and invade your field and infect your field that you didn't want it there, they lay claim and they say that you violated their patent and they sue you and they put you out of business. That is the strong tactics and the scum tactics of Monsanto. Keep an eye on them, folks, and revolt the only way you can, by doing something for yourself and supporting the people that do more than you can. And those are the small seed houses. Don't let them fall. Because I guarantee you right now, they're on a list. They're on a list right at Monsanto headquarters, and their goal is to one way or another gain control or put them out of existence. Because once they do that, they've won. There's no one left. All right, so a little bit of an upbeat and kind of, you know, some practical advice for how to do that is the next question. All right, so Rob sends me this email and says he lives in Wisconsin, but not exactly where he lives in Wisconsin, so I'm going to do the best I can. Wisconsin is split by USD zones 4 and 5. Some of the stuff that I'm going to give you as advice is zone 5 and up, so you have to determine for yourself what part of your state you're in, or you have to do things to increase radiant energy, and you can stretch zone 5 product into zone 4. But here's his question before I go any deeper into that. His property borders a small public woodland, and since this property's not very large, their thought is they could use that bordering woodland as the basis for the canopy layer and a multi-layered permaculture system, and then begin their plantings at the edge and move forward without actually planting their own high canopy trees. And that's a great idea. I love it. They actually talked to the people that manage it for the city or state or whatever, whoever owns the public land, and they said they had no problem with this as long as they didn't plant anything invasive or illegal. So he's not going to have any issues there. So what he wants to know, though, is what are some things that they can plant in there, specifically vines and climbers, small trees that can handle the cold Wisconsin winters, that will also be productive and provide fruits and or something edible. All right, so great question. Let's start out with the way the property lays. Being able to do things, like I said, like stretch the zone a little bit, if you're a little bit into zone 4 and be able to plant some things that are typically zone 5 and up, would be very possible if you have an ideal situation. The ideal situation is the woods are on the north side of your property, so you get solar exposure to the front of them all year long. Even when the sun goes low in the sky, you're still getting good solar exposure there. If the woods are on the south side, and they're going to cast a shadow forward, it's going to be a lot more difficult to even do your standard plan. If it's east or west of you, or some combination thereof, you'll have varying levels of success. But ideally, if I was looking for a property that already had an existing canopy layer, I would want that existing canopy layer to be on the north side of the property, so that I get southern solar exposure, at least in the northern hemisphere. That's what I would want. All right, so with that in mind, temper the advice I'm going to give you with that. The next thing I would say is one of your big problems is not just the cold itself, but your prevailing winds. You need to determine the direction of your prevailing winds. You could probably do that by looking at trees and bushes that are already around the area. You know they're not going to it's that wind direction. It's not going to come from behind your woodlot, because your woodlot's a windbreak. It's already got a windbreak. So you'll be able to see with ground erosion and tree erosion, your wind is primarily west to east to west, northeast, southeast, whatever it is. Whatever that direction is, you need to go to that edge of your property. You need to create windbreaks. One of the great windbreaks that will handle zone 5 and probably zone 4 if you got good solar exposure would be filberts, and create a filbert hedge. Or you could also maybe do a gooseberry hedge. Gooseberries are going to have no problem whatsoever, multiple different gooseberries. Create a wind block, though, because you're trying to shelter your plantings beyond just having something that can survive the cold, the wind, the erosion. When you do permaculture, you're looking not just at hardiness, you're looking at energy. And there's a tons of different types of energy. There's solar energy, there's wind energy, there's warm energy, there's cool energy, and you have to decide which energy do you want to invite into the property and which energy do you want to obstruct from the property. Well, cold, harsh wind, especially in a northern environment, is something you want to obstruct. So you need to plant a good hedgerow there. Now, on your canopy, what I would suggest is possibly go ahead and plant some dwarf and semi-dwarf trees. Come in with maybe apples or some other type of cold hardy tree. Cornelian cherry will probably be able to handle this, and pawpaw will be able to handle your environment, and plant like a row of semi-dwarf, let's say 20 feet apart. If your back property is only 60 feet, it's just 3 fruit trees, but that's a ton. Then come in front of them with semi-dwarf. And you can do things with your 2 layers to help with pollination. In other words, if you have an apple tree as a dwarf, one of your semi-dwarfs, which you'll have room if you do 3 full-size trees, maybe you have room for 4 to 6. Small dwarf trees, full dwarfs, maybe it's another variety of apple, maybe it's a variety of crab apple, and you get good cross-pollination there. For your vines and climbers, look to kiwi. Kiwi is an overlooked plant. It's thought of as being something tropical. There's a Siberian version of kiwi that will handle temperatures way colder than you're ever going to see in Wisconsin. Way colder, down into the double negative digits several times over. And that's without the shelter that you're going to be able to provide with your wind breaks and your solar exposure and everything else. You might even get away with planting maypop, as crazy as it sounds, which is a northern variety, basically, of passion fruit that can handle into zone 5. It freezes to the ground every year, and then it regrows, and it produces fruit every year. And they're a really cool fruit. The thing with maypop is, as cold as it gets there, you're going to need to, when that plant hits the ground, when it's been killed by the first killing frost, just put about a foot of mulch on top of the root system, at least. And mulch everything. You'll be able to, for climbers, if you like hops, you'll be able to grow hops. There's even some varieties of grapes that will do okay in your environment with the right solar exposure. But for your climbers, you don't necessarily have to have perennials. You plant all your perennial trees, then come in and plant like on your, near your dwarf trees and your semi-dwarfs, climbing beans. Scarlet runners will do good in your cool summers with a lot of sunlight. They'll do wonderful. You can plant your vegetables in and around your trees that prefer shade in the summertime. Minimal shade. They don't want huge amounts of shade, but especially for your first few years, you can go in there with different lettuces in the summertime that would get sun scorched if they were out in your main vegetable garden getting too much solar exposure. Next layer out, come in with shrubs and bushes. And this is another place where you can put in things like goji berry, which is a zone 5 and up. But if you protect it, you can probably get by into a little bit of zone 4. Gooseberry, currant, serviceberry, saskatoon, honeyberry, all of these things. Blackberry will generally be able to survive. Raspberry will generally be able to survive because they're designed to die back. Again, anything that dies back, with as cold as your winters are, you want to mulch it. You may even be able to get some northern clumping varieties of bamboo to survive if you have a situation where, let's say your wind is coming west to east, you're going to get good solar exposure to the west in the early part of the day to warm it up, and if you plant your clumping bamboos over as a windbreak, you may be able to pull that one off. I'm not sure. The specs that the plants come with will say you can't do it, but I have seen bamboo grown up into zone 5. It can be done with the right, and it can be even done into zone 4 with ideal circumstances. The other thing that you're going to want to do is don't try to make your landscape look like the typical suburban landscape. Go out and find big chunks of rock. There's plenty of it all over Wisconsin. I've been there. I've seen it myself. Place big rocks in and amongst your bushes, your shrubs, and your low tree layers so that they're designed to be able to take in a lot of heat from the sun. Those rocks will warm quite a bit and help warm the ground and help warm the surrounding area, extend your growing season, and help shelter your plants through the coldest part of the winters. So those are kind of some of the ideas that I can give you in that cold, very northern temperate environment. You have to deal with things I don't have to deal with down here in Texas or up in Arkansas, but all of those types of things can be done. There's things you can't do. Olives and figs, forget about it. It's not going to happen unless you put in a great big greenhouse. put your trees on caster wheels, roll them out to be part of the environment through the summer, and bring them in the winter. And that's not a bad idea. That is the other thing I would definitely advise. If you have the space for it, even if it's a relatively small, maybe a 6x10 or an 8x12 greenhouse, put in a greenhouse. You will not regret it. It will extend your growing season right through the winter. As long as you keep the snow off and the sun inside it, you'll be able to go grow cool weather crops in the coldest time of the year. You'll be able to take some things that are maybe potted variety plants that you could never grow in Wisconsin, even things like citrus. And as long as you bring them in at the right times of the year, they'll be able to survive and you'll be able to extend that growing season and that growing variety. And they can be put out throughout the entire part of the year where freezing is not a danger, and that adds to the biodiversity of your system, bringing things that you would think could never be there into them. And, you know, sometimes things happen for a reason, and I didn't get to air this show yesterday, and I rewatched a show last night on Google Video that I'll put a link into today, and it's given me an idea that might be really good for you guys. I don't know how big your property is, but if it's big enough, this might be a really cool way to pull off everything I just said and add another component into it. This video is called Backyard Permaculture. It's by an Aussie guy, and he might be, as one of my British friends would say, a little light in the loafers, but is excited and kind of happy and all as he is. He seems like he really knows what he's doing, and he put together a really amazing, just over an hour-long video. And one of the things that he did on his property is on the back fence row, he put in a chicken house and a chicken run, and he put chickens in there. Inside the chicken run, he's growing fruit trees. Now, what he did is he put tires around the root system to protect them and then wrapped the fruit trees in chicken wire so the chickens can't damage the trees when they're young. And, of course, once they get big enough, that won't be a concern anymore. They'll be able to remove the chicken wire. He also planted plants inside the chicken runs, which are just like long, narrow runs that go back to the chicken house out the back fence and the side fence. He planted things in there like rue and wormwood and things that chickens could eat and would be natural repellents. But he also put those in tires and wrapped them in wire so that once they grow enough, the pieces that stick out, the chickens can take some of it but can't kill the plant. Really ingenious. Then, in front of the chicken run, moving back toward the house, he put up a trellis. In that trellis, and he put it off the chicken coop again so the chickens can't reach through and destroy, because when things are young and tender, chickens will destroy everything. You have to control them. So maybe keeping about a 6-inch gap, he put this trellis in. Along the trellis, he planted more fruit trees, and he did them in an espalier fashion, where they're grown small and two-dimensional, so they grow out laterally. So that would become like your semi-dwarf layer. And then in front of there, you can plant your gooseberries and all your fruits and things. That keeps the chicken coop sheltered, shaded, windbroken. Since all of these things around there are deciduous, they'll get the sun exposing them in the winter. But they'll be protected with shade in the summer and kept somewhat cool. Because you have the runs, you can segment the runs and control where they go so they only scratch so much in one place at one time. He puts a ton of mulch in there. That mulch then gets thrown to the compost bin as it's replaced and then put on all the plants and things throughout his system. That might be a really cool way to take, you know, that canopy system that's already there, let that provide shade and shelter in the summertime for the chickens, and build your layers coming out from the front. Just thought it'd be something I'd throw in. Again, I'll put a link to this video. It's pretty freaking impressive what this guy did. And now as I close down, I want to reiterate the last thing we talked about, this Monsanto story. And I want to talk to you again about why I'm so big. Sometimes you listen to the show, you might think, is this guy a survivalist, right? Or is he Howard Garrett, the dirt doctor? I mean, is this guy an organic gardener? Or is he a guy that's worried about self-sufficiency? I'm a guy that's worried about self-sufficiency. That's my primary thing. I want self-sufficiency and individual freedom for as many people as possible. So that if we're self-sufficient, we have individual freedom, and the systems around us fail, we might be uncomfortable, but we're going to survive. That's the point of being self-sufficient. But I want it to be a lifestyle that empowers you, not just something you do in case something bad happens. More times than not, something bad is not happening. We need to build lifestyles that can make our living better today and insure us against disaster and catastrophe tomorrow. That's the sensible way to approach survivalism. Nothing is more important than the ability to produce, manage, and control your food supply. right? We think we need energy. But 150 years ago, we had no energy. We think we need computers. 70 years ago, we had no computers. People lived. You tell me a period in time where people survived without food for very long. They might go a couple weeks. But sooner or later, they start dropping over. Food, you cannot be without. Water, you cannot be without. Shelter, you cannot be without. The same rules that we learn in the wilderness, we should take to our homes. Ensure that you will never lose your shelter. Don't buy what you can't afford. Pay it off as quickly as possible. Buy in a place where your taxes are low as possible. Make your home a producer, not a consumer. Most people's home are the biggest consumers in their lives. They work 40 to 60 hours a week, and 80% of that time or more goes into providing for their home. Between mortgage, insurance, taxes, electric bills, and everything else they have to spend to stay in their home, cable bills, all of it. 80% of their effort is to provide for their home. Our homes are supposed to provide for us. The dynamic has been flipped around. That's why they created suburbs, to lead us into that trap. People came to this country for land. Land that could produce. Instead of being a serf and having the stuff you produced taken by a nobleman, you kept it, you used it, and you profited from it. You took the surplus and you returned it into the marketplace locally. And you took the subsistence amount and you used it for yourself. And it is the only way that we will make a stand. It is the only way that we will preserve our freedom and our way of life. It is that important. It is that critical. I am not exaggerating. I am not going into sensationalism. If you can feed and shelter yourself, if you can take care of yourself for your basic needs, if you can provide water for yourself and your crops, you can survive. If you cannot do that, you will not survive in the wilderness for very long alone. It will not happen. If we ever end up in a situation that's that bad, then people will move across that vast expanse like maggots, eating at its very flesh until there is very little left. Only communities that are strong and built on strength and integrity and decency and fertility and understanding of the concept of surplus and abundance will survive long term. That will be the only ones. There may be a need to defend them. I know that. I hear people all the time that are wilderness freaks. Well, if you have a garden, somebody might come take it away. Somebody might come take your house. Somebody might come take your car. Somebody might come take anything that you own. It doesn't mean you don't own them. It doesn't mean you don't do the smart, right things. But more importantly, without the big Hollywood disaster, the simple move toward globalization and control of people via economics and politics. The only way to resist it is to be able to provide for yourself. Water? Water ain't as hard as we think it is. There's a lot of ways to take care of water. It falls out of the sky, even in the driest environments. If we learn to use it efficiently, we can make do and get most of the water that we need, except in the harshest environments. And even in those positions, like you fucking, well, yeah, but from Southern California. Your problem in Southern California isn't how little rain there is. It's how many people there are. It's too densely populated. The land is not designed to support that many people. You have too many people in your state, and you have too many people in certain portions of your state. And you have a government that's too stupid to let you have water running to land that needs it. On top of that. But in most environments, if you get out of densely populated situations, you can figure out how to handle water. As long as your state's not a Nazi and tells you you don't own the water that's on your property. And that is an issue, and you have to think about that. Shelter? It's tough. It's not like it used to be. You can't just go out in the middle of the wilderness, lay claim to 40 acres, and build a cabin. And you probably don't want to. You probably need some help creating your home. You'll have to pay for it. Pay for it quickly. And buy it in a place where it will not become a burden to you for the rest of your life. Because even if you pay your house off in suburbia, you may end up spending $6,000 to $10,000 a year in the coming years just on taxes on your property. That's not unheard of. I have friends in New Jersey paying $12 on theirs, and then feed yourself. You do those things, then you've got something. Then you'll survive anything. I've got a lot of people emailing me about this report that came out with these people, the preppers. Rise of the Preppers is the article, Newsweek. You know what? The one thing I saw there, I didn't see anybody growing a dram of food. The guy out in the desert, he seemed pretty cool. I'm going to try to get him on the show as a guest. He probably does grow his own food. They never talked about that. All they talked about was storing food. Storing food is finite. It is a good thing to do. I recommend it. I think you should do it. But it is finite. You can only store so much food. You only have so much space, and you only have so much money. If you can't produce some, you live, and all you've done, I've talked about this before, you've shifted the fear. The fear that I may not be able to get the food, to the fear that I may be able to run out of the food. Why do you think so many survivalists are paranoid? Why do you think they're so worried that their neighbor might know that they have food? Because they have fear. If you're living in fear, you're not a survivalist. You're paranoid. With a focus on survival. Survivalists, modern survivalists, live with power and knowledge that they control their own destiny. And they're good citizens in their community. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up today. I hope my remake of this show was as good as the one I did yesterday. I think I did pretty good. I know I left one thing out. Those solar panels at Home Depot, I talked about doing Newsweek's job for them, or USA Today, or whoever the paper was. The solar panels, I believe, are 175-watt panel. I went to the manufacturer's website. The manufacturer's called Akina. No specs on the panels. On Seeking Alpha, I found some investigating stuff into investing in the company, and it looks like the panels are 175-watt panels. If so, it's a pretty decent deal at $875, and you plug it straight into your AC, your power source. So check those things out. Check out all the links today. And with that, this has been Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.